Good morning. If you're joining us off net, this is the Senate Finance Committee. We're in Juneau, Alaska, in the state capitol, room 532. Today is Friday, April 3rd, 2015, at 9:35 a.m. With me at the table this morning, Vice Chairman Michicki. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and myself, Senator McKinnon. We'll be joined shortly by Senator Kelly, who is taking care of state business. On today's agenda, we have SB 86, Refined Fuel Surcharge and Motor Vehicle Tax. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Senator Michicki, if you could move the CS before the committee.
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 8629-LS0675-F before the committee as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Erin Shine from my office will identify herself for the record and speak to the changes in the Finance Committee substitute.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Erin Shine and I'm staff to Senator McKinnon. There are three changes in the CS that's before you. The first change is on page 1, line 11. Point 008 was removed and replaced with point 0095. The second change is on page 2, line 4. There's a new number 4. It now states aviation fuel. The third change is on page 5, line 7. And this was replaced, aviation facilities was removed and replaced with capital or operating costs of airports.
Thank you, Ms. Shine. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, Senator Olson.
Madam Chairman, could you, Ms. Shine, could you just go ahead and remind me again, there's the second point, the second change related to aviation fuel?
Yes. So on page 2, line 4, the new number 4, previously it had stated fuel sold for use in jet propulsion aircraft operating in flights to a foreign country or that continue from foreign countries. It now just states aviation fuel.
One more question, Madam Chair.
Certainly, Senator Olson.
On line 15, we also see aviation fuel that is, I know it's not a change, but what effect does that have on this, on the aviation community?
Sorry, on page
2, line 15. It's an established amount, I'm sorry.
I think that's, Madam Chair, I think that this might be a question best served through the sponsor of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Shine. Senator Michicki.
Yeah, Senator Olson, through the chair, just restating the existing taxes. So this surcharge exempts aviation fuels, but it lists the existing taxes on this page.
One further question, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Has anybody spoken to, for or against the changes to the CS?
We had some difficulties with aviation fuel because of FAA regulations. All surcharges have to be returned to the airport. We believe we have adequate funding for aviation fuel related spills, so we just decided it wasn't necessary to collect from that segment of refined fuels.
Actually, Madam Chairman, my question was on the changes to the CS, the three that were there, have there been any outside interest, outside of aviation, that have either spoken in favor of or against the CS changes?
Just the department, and I did not speak directly with the aviation folks, but the departments were concerned with how they would manage that fund if it included aviation fuel. So they're in support of the changes. I don't know that they were opposed to it before that, but we're looking for the simplest process on covering costs for the SPAR fund, and this seemed to be the simplest process.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. No further questions.
Senator Dunleavy, followed by Senator Hoffman.
Just a real quick question, Madam Chair, to the sponsor. Is there a difference, or should there be a difference between aviation fuel and aviation gasoline? Aviation fuel, is it all... Are there differences within the fuel, and is gasoline something that's more specific, or should that be fuel as well?
I honestly, Madam Chair, cannot answer that question other than the fact that we're not changing any aviation fuels. I don't know if gasoline is purchased off-site, if that's a different situation. We have folks from Department of Environmental Conservation and Department of Revenue here that could perhaps help with that after we present the bill, Madam Chair, if we can table that question for a moment.
Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Olson.
We're just on that point, Madam Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Has to do, when you're dealing with aviation fuel in general, it's both gasoline, which is a combustible, highly combustible, as well as all the jet fuels, the Jet A, Jet B, JP1, JP2, and all that other stuff. Usually, at least in the industry, industry, everything is included with aviation fuel.
Okay, so.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, that's all I was saying is there may be two different things here. One be gas, which is a subset of the fuel umbrella.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What was anticipated on page 1, line 11, under the .008 scenario, and what is that, the $7.5 million, and what is anticipated under the new number of 9.5?
Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, the amount is essentially the same. We increased from 0.8 to 0.95 because of the aviation exemption.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Ms. Schein.
Yeah, if I can just add something that Senator Hoffman, through the Chair, we do have forthcoming fiscal notes that would update the numbers on the on two fiscal notes with the 0.0095. We have not received those, but it would be adjusted a little bit because of the exemption from aviation fuel, as well as raising the number.
Thank you. Is there I have an objection on the table. I'll remove my objection on the CS. Is there an objection on adopting the CS? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for Senate Bill Number 86, Finance, is before the committee. Thank you, Ms. Schein. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Before us is a CS for Senate Bill Number 86, Finance. Senator Michicki, welcome to the microphone. If you could introduce your staff, and then please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peter Michicki, District O, and with me is my Chief of Staff, Larry Simmons. Madam Chair, spill response and prevention is very important to the environment and health of Alaska. We talk a lot about keeping the EPA out of our business. And we do that with spills by managing the program through state privacy with DEC. If we were not to fund the program, we'd likely be paying feds to manage them for us, and I strongly doubt we would like the result. The response fund was originally created in 1976 as the Coastal Protection Fund, and then the world changed in 1989. In the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill federal law titled the Oil Protection Act of 1990 required a higher level of response. Today's Spill Prevention and Response Fund, or the SPAR Fund, was the answer to allow a reliable source of funds for DEC activities related to spill response and prevention. A loss of this department would also stall all future oil and gas development that requires sea plans and response drills and exercises. Why this is important to pass this session, Madam Chair, is that the state was willing to sort of jump in and spend $800,000 in reappropriations for FY15, the shortfall in FY15, as well as millions in the future, covering a fund for spills the state should not be responsible to cover. This surcharge that we're proposing provides a spiller pays user fee or surcharge. The response fund has been financed in the past with a 5 cent per barrel surcharge on oil produced. That continues. However, revenues have been reduced just due to the reduction in oil production. The prevention account simply doesn't have enough adequate funding to cover essential services. And a variety of industries and individuals spill oil and hazardous substances. Homeowners, mines, fuel shippers, boat owners, mom-and-pop dry cleaning establishments, and village tank farms. And there's a graphic in your packet that sort of outlines the types of spills. Note that in 2014, of the 2028 spills reported, 1,525 of them were refined fuel spills. Also, 75% to 80% of contaminated sites in Alaska are the result of refined fuel spills. And so you might ask, why is there sometimes no way to collect for spills requiring response? Sometimes we discover these spills years after the owners of a previous site are dead and gone. Sometimes it's grandma's 350-gallon heating fuel spill, and she simply has the inability to pay. In other cases, like recently, there was a fuel spill discovered on the Dalton Highway. The truck was gone. The spill remained. So the state is on the hook for some of those. And the way it's been divided in the past is there's the prevention and response accounts. 95% of all of these smaller spills are paid out of the prevention account, and all of this surcharge will go into that prevention account. So it's a direct response to those spills. And it spreads the cost of prevention and response across all users of refined fuel, and this goes to the distributors. Some would like to add additional surcharge on the producer per barrel fee, and we considered this option very seriously, and in a moment I'll cover why we decided to go this way. Those producers do not use these funds when they have a spill. They actually clean up the spill, or they write a check for those that clean up the spill, and they reimburse the state for any state involvement in a spill. The other thing is, putting a higher surcharge on the producers results in less royalty. They write off those costs, so it results in less royalty to the general fund. There's also been a fairly significant reduction in risk. OPA 90 required double-hull tankers. They have response plans. We're also shipping, the state producers are shipping significantly lower quantities of crude oil. And then there's a value in spill prevention versus the cost of cleaning up a spill. And part of this is I'm asking the department for greater public awareness. Little things that they can suggest for homeowners, like flexible tubing from the oil storage tank to the home, that dramatically reduces the potential for spilling that 300-gallon tank in the yard. Filter guards, better tank spans or stands. We want them to remind vessel owners not to top off their tanks in the late fall, which expand and then leak out of the vents in boatyards all over the state. So we're hoping that prevention improves as well. The mechanics of this bill is, in order to minimize the implementation costs, this surcharge is going to be paid by the distributors of fuel that are already reporting and paying motor fuel tax. So they'll use the same forms, very low cost. Other options had a very high cost of implementation. One note I saw was $700,000. So we'll talk about the fiscal notes in just a moment. This bill affects AS 4340, which is the motor fuel tax section of the law. We're not increasing motor fuel taxes. This is a surcharge, the 0.95 cents per gallon, and it's not intended to change the motor fuel law at all. Some of the changes in the bill are conforming, so that it is clear that the particular sections apply only to motor fuel tax. We have letters from the Cook Inlet, RCAC, the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, the Council of Alaska Producers, and over 40 individuals in support. In a previous committee, we heard from the Alaska Trucking Association in favor of the bill. We have not received opposition. So why did I choose to not put additional surcharge on the per barrel fee? We looked at whether or not the industry is taking responsibility. And since OPA 90, they've created the Prince William Sound RCAC. That's $3.8 million a year. Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, that's $1.3 million. There's now CERVS, Alaska Clean Seas, CISPRI, which is the Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response, TAPS. The industry spends about $200 million additional dollars in spill prevention and response. And then for an example, they had one drill last year in Prince William Sound that cost the industry $1.8 million. So they're doing what they should be doing. They're also paying for all the spills in the state, even though they pay for their own spills. They're paying for all those other dry cleaning fluid spills and refined fuel spills in the state. So this is a user pays fee that spreads across a greater base. And I just wanted to close, Madam Chair, with the fact that we hear from folks that DEC is not efficient with this fund, but although there's always room for improvement, my experience has been otherwise. My goal through the passage of this bill is to work with DEC to improve prevention, reducing the need for response, requiring the department to collect from sellers when they have the ability to pay, and hopefully eventually reducing the need for the user pay surcharge. They put out a biannual report. I'd like to see greater detail on improvement in the prevention side. My goal in the future, this is an important bill to get through this session, and if this gets over to the other side, we may suggest that they require a higher insurance bonding for transporters right now, making sure that they have the financial ability to respond to their own spills as well. So with that, I'm going to close, and Mr. Simmons, I don't know if you have anything you want to add, but we do have the Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Revenue here for comments as well.
Larry, any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not at this time. I'm here to answer questions if needed.
The bills before the committee, Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently in state law, there's different tax rates for different products. Aviation fuel, I believe, is 5%. I mean, aviation fuel is 2.5%. Marine fuel is 5 cents. Diesel is 8 cents. And I think there was a reason for the different levels of taxation. And I think heating fuel, and I may be wrong on this, has been exempt from state taxes. And I'm wondering, does this include heating fuel as well? And why are we having a flat tax and not a graduated tax, as is the case with our current tax structure on fuel?
Senator Machicki.
Well, we wanted a simplified process, and a vast majority of the spills have to do with home heating fuels, unfortunately. So again, this is a user fee, essentially. We're hoping to spread the cost, place the cost where the spills occur. And again, you can, when the Department of Revenue comes up, we can talk to you, and you can ask the questions you want to about aviation fuel and some of those others. We tried to apply the surcharge to the folks that are causing the spills, and although the fuel tax may not be placed on some of those segments of the users, partially that's because they're not using the highways. It's not going toward road improvement and things like that. This is a different fund. This is about helping to clean spills where the spills occur.
I understand that. I'm just finding out, is there equity in the new tax structure? I understand the principle behind this new tax.
One of the things that we calculated is we hope the cost is not passed down to the consumer, but we know that often occurs. If it does occur, if you think about what you use per year, the average family is probably going to be $4 or $5 a year in total. And when you think about the state responsibilities, to me, it just didn't seem right that the state was on the hook in these times of really challenged finances. I think a user fee is probably most appropriate these days.
And, Madam Chair, I would state that charging the tax on a per gallon, not a percentage of price, makes much more sense.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Machicki, I thought I heard you say, and I wonder if you would clarify, you've been working or in discussions with carriers, common carriers, on looking at increasing insurance premiums for tankers. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator Bishop. We have spoken to the Alaska Truckers Association. We are in conversations. We have very little time left in this session. It's a very important bill to get through, or else the state is on the hook for these costs. But we are going to try to get that inserted as this bill goes across on the House side. We believe we have time for that amendment.
Madam Chairman, is DEC here for questions?
They are. We're going to bring them up after the public hearing.
Thank you.
If that's all right.
Thank you.
Any other questions to understand the document before us? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say you were going to go over the fiscal note?
We will review that when we get ready to pass out, I believe, Madam Chair.
That is correct.
So this is not the time to do it?
No.
Okay.
Senator Olson.
Just a comment. It looks like they're pushed to have everybody go on to natural gas as opposed to using heating fuel. Is that kind of the underthrust of a gentleman that's pushing for the end of the natural gas pipeline?
Well, I
saw your... Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. What I'd like to do now with the support of the committee is go to the public who have been waiting to testify. I would like to advise the committee that Kristen Ryan from DEC is in the room. She is the director, the division director of the Spill Response Division. We also have online Ken Alpar from the Department of Revenue Taxation Division, and I thought I saw Jerry here. He might have just stepped out. Okay, I'd like to open the public testimony on the CS for Senate Bill number 86, an act relating to a refined fuel surcharge relating to motor fuel tax relating to qualified dealer license and providing for an effective date. The public hearing is open on Senate Bill 86. Is there anyone online? Kara Moriarty, welcome to Senate Finance.
Good morning, Co-Chairman McKinnon and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. AOGA is the professional trade association for the oil and gas industry, and we do represent the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, transporters, and marketers. Because this legislation is a tax-related matter, this testimony that I'm going to give today had to have the unanimous consent from all of our member companies, producers, and refineries alike. In addition to the hundreds of millions of dollars invested each year by the industry in Alaska to prevent, prepare, and respond to the release of hazardous substances, AOGA has long supported a fair and equitable effort to ensure the state of Alaska is also financially prepared. As was stated by the bill sponsor, right now the state has only collected a surcharge on the oil and gas industry to pay for the spill response fund, which we refer to as the 470 fund, since 1989. As it is, if an oil industry-related incident occurs, again, Senator Michicki mentioned that the industry is on the hook for and repays the costs associated with the response, as do other regulated industries. To date, I think it's important to note that the oil and gas industry has contributed more than $350 million through this surcharge for this fund. Again, Senator Michicki stole my thunder, mentioned that, the DEC is doing a much better job than it has in the past in utilizing this fund for actual cleaning up and preventing spills. Previous administrations and legislatures had allowed the fund to be used for several non-spill related projects, but and the corpus of the fund may have been unnecessarily reduced during those years when these types of appropriations were authorized. But again, we don't see, it doesn't appear that that's happening today. So overall, we endorse the same position that the transition team for the Walker-Mallott administration had on this issue, which advocated for the state to utilize other revenue sources before increasing the surcharge on the oil and gas industry. And as been stated, Senate Bill 86 does broaden the contributing efforts of others that use the fund services. Additionally, we will work with DEC to continue to identify efficiencies, and we will work with the state to identify cost reductions without diminishing the state's strong oversight and regulation of the industry. We would also encourage the state to adopt other policies to assist the state in recovering costs from other users who are not currently reimbursing the state after a response. So in closing, Chair McKinnon and members of the committee, AOGA is not opposed to this bill. The bill does broaden the contributions of others that use the fund services without significantly impacting our member companies. And so with that, I apologize I couldn't be in Juneau today in person, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there questions for Ms. Moriarty? Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today. Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, just a statement. I just wanted to clarify that when I'm not here, and this bill's not related to anything to do with where I work when I'm not here, but I do work for ConocoPhillips when I'm not in session. However, ConocoPhillips is not a member of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. I just wanted to clarify that for the record.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying, Ms. Moriarty. Here in Juneau, we have two folks signed up to testify. Douglas Mertz. Mr. Mertz, if you're here. If you'd identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Douglas Mertz. I represent the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. The RCAC was founded pretty closely after the Exxon Valdez disaster, and it was founded with the intention of becoming the preeminent source of expertise and watchdog on oil spill matters in Prince William Sound. As such, it has developed a fund of expertise on spill prevention and response that is the best in Alaska and one of the best in the world. As for myself, I was an assistant attorney general specializing in oil spill matters before and after the Exxon Valdez, and participated in stakeholder discussions that led to enactment of what we have today in the statute. When we were considering, soon after the Exxon Valdez, how to structure a oil spill prevention and response capacity in the state, we had several things that we considered critical. The first was, we all recognized that prevention is absolutely the most important thing. Generally, only about 10% of spills are cleaned up, which means the rest of it is still there. There are ongoing costs to any number of people, and the response costs for a major spill are enormous. Exxon spent over $2.5 billion on the Exxon Valdez, many times that on its Gulf spill. The state, because the state cannot always depend on a well-heeled, responsible party being there, the state potentially faces enormous costs every time there is a major spill, as well as the ongoing costs for dealing with smaller spills. So the task holder group knew that prevention was the most important thing, and what we settled on was a strategy that was two parts. One, keep it away from annual general fund appropriations, which are subject to all sorts of other political considerations. Try to come up with something else too. And two, at least roughly put the burden for paying for this system on the source of the problem. And that led to some intense discussions on how to do that. Put it on the crude industry, the refined industry, something else. At the time, we eventually concluded that there were the votes in the legislature to put the burden entirely on the crude industry. Remember, shortly after the Exxon Valdez, our friends of the crude persuasion were not the most liked people in town. So the votes were there to put it on them. But we all knew that if in the future we needed to fix that to make it more equitable or more efficient, we could come back, the legislature could come back and revisit it and come up with something that was better. And that's essentially the position we're in today. Prevention through the DEC budget is cheap insurance, and it's something that we strongly believe must be maintained in some fashion. And the current system has worked up until now, and you all know the source of the budgetary problem. Changing it in a way that spreads the burden a little more equitably probably makes more sense. Exactly how you do it, the details are, to us, are secondary to having the funds there regularly in a way that the public can count on for both prevention and response activities. So we strongly urge your support for this bill.
Are there questions from committee members? Mr. Mertz, thank you for coming to Juneau and testifying today.
Thank you.
Vince O'Shea, welcome to Senate Finance. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record, and then please proceed with 3 minutes of testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. My name is Vince O'Shea, and I work for the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. I live here in Juneau. And PSPA is a trade organization of 9 seafood processing companies who collectively own and operate more than 26 fish processing plants in Alaska. Our association was founded in 1914, and one of our members traces their origin to operating in Alaska even prior to then. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about SB 86. One of our interests here is many of our plants consume a considerable amount of refined fuel producing their own electricity in the remote areas. So we're looking at this. One of the things that I we're pleased with is this approach spreads the burden of trying to restore the fund across a broad range of users, and I think that's a very positive thing. We also strongly agree with the value of prevention. That's a good investment. Keeping the oil where it's supposed to be is far easier than trying to clean it up, and far cheaper as well. We are concerned about the 30% collection rate within DEC. So it seems to me that this, and I know there's reporting requirements now for DEC, but it seems to me that if you all could take a look at perhaps improving the transparency of DEC collection efforts, that this could perhaps give a bit of encouragement to DEC and remove some of individual employee discretion, if you will, to who gets a pass on whether they pay money back into the fund. And I think the last thing is, earlier this morning, the sponsor had mentioned what the impact would be to, say, a homeowner, for example, with this. Just to give you an idea of rough numbers, two of our members operate plants. I asked them for their consumption last year, and it was 1.1 million, and the second plant was 1.6 million gallons of diesel fuel a year they're running through their plants. So, as I said, we have 26 plants throughout Alaska. Some of those are on city power, so it's not necessarily going to have those numbers on everybody. But roughly, it's at the 0.0095, roughly $10,000 a million. So you can see what the impact is. With that, Madam Chair, so we certainly wouldn't oppose it, and would request you consider those additions to the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you for coming to Senate Finance today.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else online wishing to testify on Senate Bill 86? Is there anyone else here in Juneau wishing to testify on Senate Bill 86, an act relating to refined fuel surcharge? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. For the committee's benefit, we do have the department. I would like to ask DEC to the table. And then if Mr. Alpar could stand by, I know he's online trying to continue his work from off-net, so we appreciate that, Mr. Alpar. Thank you for joining us online. Ms. Ryan, the last person who testified before us has at least asserted that there may be less than transparency in how we are accounting for collections. If you could respond to that and then let me know what his reference meant to a 30% collection rate, that would be helpful.
For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I am the Director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Department of Environmental Conservation. The previous speaker was referencing a cost recovery percentage. In FY14, our recovery rate was 30%. Of what we build out. There are several factors for why that's low, and I'll explain those, and then I will also explain some of the things I'm doing to improve that number. Many of our cost recovery efforts take years. For example, a large contaminated sites like Flint Hills is a very good example right now. We have built the Coke Industries $4 million to recover some of our costs associated with the cleanup of that site. And we are in court to get those costs reimbursed. It will take several years before we're able to recover those costs. So it's difficult on an annual basis to show immediate recovery of costs. Many of our more expensive sites take many years before we see that. Another large settlement coming in is from the federal government for a school site in Aniak. There's $5 million owed to us from various federal agencies for a school in Aniak that was contaminated and some cleanup that went wrong. It's taken us 10 years to get that, but we're expecting it any day, but we've been saying that for a year. So, and these are things outside of our control. That's departmental law that manages those settlements for us, and sometimes they settle for less than what we put into it just to close the case out.
Ms. Rain, from an accounting perspective then on billed items, then do you bill that annually? And so you're carrying forward all your litigation instead of setting it aside as a how can we see, from the transparency assertion, how can we see what is actually unbilled versus a current year versus carryover from previous years that were in litigation so that the general public can see that we are acting on behalf of the people of Alaska to recover from the federal government, to recover from a private company? Can you tell me, are you implementing changes to do that, or we just have a big number and we always look like we have a low percentage of collection?
Madam Chairman, there's a few things we can do, and we are working to improve just our day-to-day cost recovery when we go help an individual with a spill, which would be recovered, you know, rather immediately. So, for example, last year we've automated our billing. We used to do it manually. That caused problems. We now are using a time tracking system. We started last year with a time tracking system so that we in management can see what people are doing with their time and if they aren't billing their services out. So that there are certain things that we've implemented recently to try to improve on that, to show that what's happening on an annual basis and what we're recovering. Now, those longer-term cases, those do get carried forward, and we can document and show those. I mean, I can provide them to the committee, all of the long-term formal cost recovery cases we have in place. So we can segregate those out and provide them separately.
Is the committee interested in receiving that documentation? I'd like to receive it, so if you could pass it to me, if there's others who want it, I'm happy to distribute it after we see that. There's been also an assertion at today's table that individuals are making those decisions as far as pursuing claims. What are the checks and balances in place for the general public to have confidence that the department is managing outstanding debt appropriately?
Madam Chairman, one issue I mentioned is the time tracking. That's a new thing we've implemented this year where we as managers now have a better sense of what people are doing with their time. They have to charge their time to a specific code, so we can see when codes are perhaps being used that shouldn't be or that the cost recovery isn't occurring. A large percentage of our work is prevention-oriented. Not all of it, not half of it, but probably about 30 to 40%. And that is unrecoverable. That is work we're doing. We don't bill for that. It's just we've never had. It's always been the standard that the surcharge would be covering our prevention work. And the users of that prevention work are paying for it. One other aspect that we've been asked to do by statute and have never done and now are working on it is to provide regulations for how cost recovery will occur. It ends up being a decision made at the department a lot more frequently than our department as to when to not pursue cost recovery. Another tool at our disposal that we are more actively utilizing is liens on property. We have several situations where we have put a lien on a property so that when the property is sold, eventually we'll get our cost recovery. But again, that's a formal matter that takes years, and that'll be part of the list we provide you.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. And this isn't on the bill, so I'll move on here in just a second. But is there a date then for the regulations to be finalized and out for the general public to review on the cost recovery?
Madam Chairman, I do not have a date yet. They're in draft form. There's many steps I unfortunately don't control, so I can't guarantee you when they'll be out. But my goal is to have them out by this time next year.
Okay. If you could speak with your commissioner, that would be helpful. Don't be surprised if there's not a follow-up email asking for a date to be written for me.
Absolutely.
With that, are there questions from committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the effective date, we have July 1. If this legislation were to pass this session, is that adequate time to implement this tax, or would a January 1 date be more reasonable?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the goal of this legislation is to generate revenue for FY16. So the intent is that it be immediately effective so that as the revenue is collected, it is turning around and going into the prevention account so that it'll solve our funding problem for FY16. There's, if it's not there, I think it will be soon, language in the operating budget that allows that immediate transfer of the funds to match up with this legislation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
I understand that. The question is, we have a July 1 effective date. Is it more reasonable to have a July 1 or a January 1 date for a smoother implementation of this tax? I understand the reasoning for the tax.
Yeah.
But you didn't answer the question.
Senator, I may not be the right person, and maybe Department of Revenue would be a better to explain to you the cost, the process for implementing the tax.
Thank you.
And the other question that I have, Madam.
Senator Hoffman, can we ask your first question to Mr. Alpar, or do you want to?
Yep. I want to finish up with.
Okay, go ahead.
The other question is, this problem of spills is not unique to the state of Alaska. How do other states pay for this type of problem? Is it, do they have different tax structures, or do they rely upon enforcement through insurance and fines?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, it is a variety. Every state does it a little differently. I think you'll see some future legislation from the administration that perhaps does things like charge a fee for leaving contamination in the ground. But most states do a variety of different funding options. It depends on the industry they have in the state and the spills that are occurring. We're not unique, but we're different in the fact that we have a large oil industry, and they're the reason we exist.
So how does, say, Texas do it?
I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Mr. Alpar, are you online?
Madam Chairman, hello?
Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Certainly, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper, A-L-P-E-R. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Alper. Did you hear Senator Hoffman's question regarding adequate time to implement this bill?
Yes, I did, ma'am. So, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, if you recall when Senator McChicky was introducing the bill, he talked about the simplicity of structure because we were appending it to the existing motor fuel tax form. Essentially, we have a group of taxpayers who already are filing taxes, already through our online system, a relatively robust and sophisticated collection mechanism. It's relatively simple to amend that, to add the new line, to change the form somewhat. We can get that through in a few months and make it possible so that this new penny, or that 9,500th of a penny, will be collectible through our monthly tax filings beginning with the next fiscal year, yes.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I fill out many of those forms.
Thank you, Mr. Alper, for joining us. Are there any further questions for the Spill Prevention Response Division Directors? Senator Bishop.
Madam Chairman, thank you. Good morning. You know, I keep going back to the prevention piece, and it's more of a comment than anything. We see diesel fuel is 60% of the culprit. So I don't need you to tell me today. I know that we're trying to. I would love to see a goal of a zero spill. Then maybe someday we could kick the penny back the other way. So that's just my comment to the department. Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy.
Is the money that comes from this bar fund, is it also used to clean up things like batteries in a parking lot or a septic system, tanker pouring septic into a lot or a pond, et cetera, et cetera?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, the statute restricts the use of this fund for oil or hazardous substances. So batteries may fall into that category, but sewage does not.
There was a question earlier. Welcome Co-Chairman Kelly to the table.
Morning.
He's been in other meetings this morning, so happy to have him with us. Senator Dunleavy, you asked a question about gasoline, and Senator Olson, as a pilot, was discussing the difference between aviation fuel. I'm wondering if we want that on the record as far as any kind of conversation of differentiation and how it affects this bill. Senator Dunleavy.
It was just a question to the sponsor of the bill if he sees any differentiation, because it seemed to be interchangeable, but you know, upon after reading it, there may have been language directed for a certain amount to be directed at aviation fuel, which from my perspective is more of an umbrella concept, and certain amount directed at aviation gasoline, which is more specific to gasoline. So anyway, it was just a question for the sponsor.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
I'd like the department to go ahead and comment on it to make sure we're all sitting on the same page. I just gave the industry, as an operator and as a former fuel dispenser myself, could you give us the definition of the aviation fuel as it pertains to this bill?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I will defer to Ken Alper. All I know is that aviation fuel included all fuel used, jet fuel through airports. But the motor fuels tax, which is in existence, the Department of Revenue would be the best source to answer that.
Mr. Alper, in the CS that was presented to the Finance Committee this morning, and I believe emailed earlier so that the Finance Committee has had it for some time, there is language that was already existing in the bill separating motor fuel out and refined fuel, and there was some terminology that changes to try to create clarity for the tax division, I believe, in collecting this proposed tax. Can you address the issue in regards to aviation fuel and the language that's in the bill versus gasoline and aviation fuel?
Certainly. Madam Chairman, can you hear me?
We can.
Hello, Madam Chair. Can you hear me, Madam Chair?
Mr. Alper, we can hear you. I don't think you can hear us.
I can hear you, yes. So I heard your question. The answer to that is we are currently collecting tax on aviation fuel and jet fuel. That's considered two different categories of taxable fuel within the existing motor fuel tax. the aviation, or what they call avgas, general aviation fuel, is 4.7 cents per gallon, and the jet fuel is 3.2 cents per gallon. The exclusion that was added, that Ms. Schein walked through earlier, to exclude aviation fuel from the surcharge, would remove that set of fuel, which in some total is 140 or 150 million gallons of fuel per year throughout the state, from being subject to this surcharge, essentially reducing the tax base, reducing the amount of fuel that's susceptible to the tax. Section 5 of the bill is amending existing language that relates to how the state uses the existing motor fuel tax for aviation. That language change was made to conform a little bit more closely with some FAA federal guidelines regarding how fuel collected at airports must be spent at those airports. Instead of the general language aviation facilities, it was more tightly constrained to capital and operating costs at airports. And then within that Section 5 of the bill, at the top of page 5, where it says motor fuel, that's to differentiate that the language of this section is only applying to the previously existing motor fuel tax and not to the new surcharge, which obviously is exempted on the aviation side.
Senator Olson, is that adequate?
Just so I can reiterate, Mr. Alper, it's that so the jet fuel was the Jet A, Jet B, JP1, and all the other jet fuels that are out there, and aviation gasoline, which includes 100 octane, low lead, and 80 octane, those are all been exempted. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the term aviation fuel in Section 2 of the bill, I'm not certain it's precisely defined in statute. However, it is our interpretation, our understanding, that the sponsor's intent in adding that language there would exempt all of the fuels you're specifically describing, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions on the bill before us? Thank you so much, Ms. Ryan. We appreciate that. Mr. Alpar, thank you for joining us online today. Senator Machicki, I would like to try to at least cover the fiscal notes.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. The first fiscal note is the Department of Revenue. The appropriation is taxation and treasury. The allocation is tax division. The OMB component number is 2476. The fiscal note for FY16 through 2021 is zero. What you'll notice in this one is it captures the change in revenue, begins at $7.5 million in FY16, and there's a 2% increase in year. That 2% increase is just the expected use increase of motor fuels that are subject to the surcharge. Then there's an estimated supplemental for FY 2015, that's the $50,000 that it could take for updating systems in the form, as well as the regulatory drafting.
Are there questions from committee members on the fiscal note? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe Ms. Schein said that we were going to get another fiscal note for the committee substitute.
We have a pending fiscal note coming. The department has advised us that these are estimates.
So we don't anticipate the revised fiscal note to change?
Senator Hoffman, we do anticipate it to change, but the change is subject to change. Mr. Teal, can you comment on the fiscal note at all? Or that's all right. Brief at ease. Brief at ease. The record. Mr. Alpar, are you still with us?
I am, ma'am.
Could you clarify the fiscal note from your division for us?
Certainly. Madam Chairman, in response to, I guess, Senator Hoffman's question, the pending fiscal note is going to reflect really two changes from what you see before you. The one change is the reduction in the tax base, the restriction of aviation fuel. On the other hand, the rate itself was increased from 8 cents, which was what the previous committee had passed out, sorry, 8 tenths of a cent to 95 hundredths of a cent. those two are roughly expected to balance each other out. The draft fiscal note I have in front of me right now that I've sent on to our leadership and it's working its way to the committee is at $7.6 million in the first year, essentially a $100,000 difference, but obviously we're working in the range of somewhat estimation because we don't know exactly how much fuel is going to come in under this surcharge next year.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would like to see the calculations by product and the 0.0095 tax structure and how that is calculated as an estimate coming up with the $7.5 million. Because we do have, Senator Olson brought up the question, and on page 2, line 15, we talk about aviation gasoline, and then on line 18, we talk about aviation fuel. And from the description that was presented to us, both of those are covered, as he said, are exempt from tax, from this tax. But on line 4, it talks about aviation fuel, and from the previous testimony, aviation fuel included aviation gas on line 15 and aviation fuel. And I'd like to see that those calculations to reflect that.
Mr. Alpar, did you capture the question?
I did, Madam Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I guess there's a couple of different things I want to raise here. First off, Section 3 of the bill is conforming language in that we're describing our existing motor fuel tax on various types of fuel in which aviation and jet fuel are captured. The primary change being made is on line 12, in addition to the surcharge, being the primary subject of the legislation before you. So the taxes on aviation remain. It's the surcharge that's excluded from aviation. What I believe the Senator is looking for, and we could certainly provide, is a brief table, a little bit of analysis of what fuel types by gallon and type are going to be subject to this surcharge versus, say, what fuel types are subject to our existing motor fuel taxes. We have done a similar analysis. It's in the committee record and the other body for the companion legislation that Representative Munoz is working with, and I will modify it somewhat to fit the specific question. I'll provide it to the committee later today.
Thank you, Mr. Alpar. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Dunleavy?
Just, I'm looking at a fiscal note that says it was prepared on 4-2-15, and it's 2-4-9-9. I'm just a little confused. Is this fiscal note not being? Okay, so with that, is the analysis, I just had a question on the analysis where it says, in short, the numbers of this fiscal note are arbitrary. I'm just wondering if that language is going to carry over to the new fiscal note.
It's my understanding, Senator Dunleavy, that it will. What I'd like to do is set this bill aside, and we will work on Senator Hoffman's clarifying questions. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing and hearing none, I would like to let the general public know that on Monday, April 6th, beginning at 9 a.m. in Anchorage, we will begin public hearing on SB 26. It's Alaska's capital budget. It will be followed by 10 o'clock, Kenai, Seward, and Homer, 11 o'clock, Matsu, Glen Allen, Delta Junction, 1:30, Barrow, Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, 2:30, Sitka, Cordova, Valdez, 3:30, Juneau, 4:30, Fairbanks, and Tok, 5:30, Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, and Unalaska, 6:30, Kodiak, and Dillingham, and 7 o'clock will begin our off-net. I am proposing, with the committee's support, to do the testimony a little bit differently, and that is we will cut off taking folks at the LIOs when their time is up and another area is going to start. And when the hour is exceeded here, we'll move to the next LIO so people that are in their LIOs on time are heard during that first time, and then we'll move back as we can to the other LIOs and pick it up. But I'm just trying to be fair so that people who are showing up on time all across Alaska get at least those folks in the queue for the hour that they're supposed to be there. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to go back to the previous piece of legislation, I support the legislation, and my intention is not to delay the passage of this bill out of committee, and I don't know what your intent is, but I can get the information subsequent to it moving out of committee if that was the original intent of the chairman.
Senator Hoffman, we have another meeting scheduled for 1:30 today. Right. We'll get the fiscal note from and make sure that committee members' questions are answered. So it's, we'll, with that, we're adjourned.